We had a dark circle after William's materializing circle, in which the child Mayflower demonstrated her ability to see in the dark, as well as we do in the light. Little Lena Lensberg had brought in her pocket a hair switch which she wanted the spirit to braid. After the circle was formed and the light extinguished, she laid it in her lap, but had said nothing of her desire until suddenly Mayflower exclaimed, "Oh, Lena, what have you got there? You want me to braid that hair, don't you? I will. But why didn't you bring the other to their art home?" She crossed the room, took the hair, braided it, and returned it to Lena's lap. She then called her to step out on the floor and see which was the taller of the two. Lena obeyed, and stood back to back with the spirit, with the following result. Chittenden, October 19, 1874. Mr. Alcott, my name is Lena Lensberg, and I am 13 years old. I was at the dark circle last night. Mayflower called me out on the floor and we measured heights. We were exactly the same. I felt her back and head against mine, and she kissed me after we measured. Lena Lensberg. Lena is rather a short girl for her age, as will be inferred by reading the certificate of a dear little girl from Utica, 2 years younger, with whom Mayflower tried the same experiment. Chittenden, October 21 St. 1874. With my father's permission, I state that my name is Cora Cecilia Ill, and I am almost 11 years old. Papa says I measure 4 feet 6 1/8 inches. Last night, Mayflower called me Birdie, and asked me to measure my height with her. We stood with our backs together, and I was about 2 inches taller than her. This was in a dark circle. Cora C. Ill. George Dix, of whose whistling accomplishments I have previously spoken, gave us a splendid display this evening. He asked Mr. Lensberg to play on his flute the Mockingbird and Home, Sweet Home very softly, which that gentleman did, and Dix whistled a tremolo accompaniment that equaled anything of the kind I ever heard. It was quite as good as the bird calls, runs, and trills of the old cigar seller at Evans Supper Rooms, in London, whom so many hundreds of American travellers must recollect. The next day was cloudy and cold, and a storm was clearly brewing among the mountain ranges. It was what might be called a fair temperature for manifestations, and we had some good ones. 31 persons attended the circle, and 9 different spirits appeared. Honto was dressed in a white dress, with black or dark overskirt, and she seemed determined that we should see more than this, for at one time she came within 2 feet of Mr. Lensberg, and lifting her skirt to her knees, displayed a good deal of a pair of white stockings. She had handsome moccasins on her feet. I noticed very closely, this evening, the vast difference between the size, height, bust, and appearance of the young lady spirit, Maggie Brown, and William Eddy. I do not know what called my attention to her so particularly, but I caught her figure and face in profile in a passably good light, and these details attracted my notice. When she held up her bouquet, as usual, for her brother to look at, her round, white, womanly arm was brought out into full view. Abraham Allsbutch's sister said to him, "Willst du an zu Haus besuchen?" To which he replied so distinctly that I caught the sound of the words, "Ah, ich gehe mit dir nach Haus morgen," which I undertake to say is more German than both of the brothers together can speak. Horatio was in one of his ugly moods this evening, which was, perhaps, attributable in part to a sound berating that old Mr. Brown, the talking spirit, gave him, and everybody in general, at the close of William's circle. I have read of Katie King's scolding visitors at the London séances, but if anybody wants to hear the thing in perfection and pretty constantly, let him stop at Chittenden a fortnight, and hear this venerable party express his views and intentions. I wanted Horatio to allow me to lay my hands lightly outside the shawl, over his hands, after they had been placed upon the bare arm of the gentleman sitter at his left, but he would not do it, but called up a lady present to hold them there, saying that one person's word was as good as another's. This was only one of many such rebuffs, so I let it pass, noting it as a suspicious circumstance, and waiting for the time when he should volunteer to give me this convincing proof of his good behavior. But the time never came, perhaps, because I had not sufficiently shown my good feeling and fairness, perhaps Comerwell, who knows. It is fair that I should say that the lady reported that he had not removed either hand from the gentleman's arm. Moreover, I must add that me, Dublovitsky, who sat at the gentleman's right, declared that she felt one hand on her right shoulder, the one farthest from the medium, at the same instant that the gentleman reported one on each of his shoulders. The guitar, two bells, and tambourine were played simultaneously, and hands of various sizes were shown. Among these, one was too peculiar to be passed over. It was a left hand, and upon the lower bone of the thumb a bony excrescence was growing, which me, Dublovitsky recognized, and said was caused by a gunshot wound in one of Garibaldi's battles. The hand grasped a broken sword that had been lying upon a table behind the shawl. It was the hand of a Hungarian officer, an old friend of the madam's, named Jan O'Nalis, and a facsimile of his own signature, written by one of his hands upon the card, is here given. Another signature, written for the same lady, was that of her husband's brother, J. Dublovitsky, a facsimile of which is also given. She asked in the Georgian language if the spirits would not again play for her the guttural air, Tyrus, Tyrus, Barber, but instead, a famous Garibaldian march, called Viva Italia, was played upon the guitar. This seemed to me a more satisfactory test than the compliance with her request would have afforded, for it was just barely possible that Horatio might have inferred that she was repeating her demand of the former light circle, and, having caught the air, would have rendered it for her, whereas, in this case, entirely different music, connected with entirely different associations, but eminently appropriate to the appearance of Jan O'Nalis, the Garibaldian soldier, was unexpectedly rendered. It is upon such tests as these, spontaneously given, that I have based my confidence in these Eddie boys. Granted that they may be able to tie and untie themselves, float instruments, ring bells, and fool intelligent persons into the belief that their hands are on their arms when, in fact, they are in quite a different place, admitting all this, I exclude from my case every individual phenomenon that can be explained upon the hypothesis of trickery, and still, as I conceive, have an abundance remaining to prove, their mediumship. If the grand expositor had shown the public a theory broad enough to cover all the appearances in William Circle, the talking children, the wrinkled old men and women, the young girls in the suppleness, freshness, and plumpness of youth, with their white, bare arms, shapely hands, and well-set heads, the diversities in height and bulk, so great as to be inexplicable to any frequenter of the coulisses upon the theory of personation, the speaking of various languages, some the most unusually known in this country, the changing of complexions from white to copper, and black to white, the faces without a sign of beard, while the medium wears a black moustache all the while, these, and, further, the exceptional tests given in Horatio's light circle, and the music playing and other marvels of his dark circle, I would have only to confess that my 2 months' labor had been wasted, and I was one more of the fools of the senses. This is just what I have waited for, and what I have not discovered. Until I do, I stand upon my story of phenomena observed, with the confidence of one whose house is built upon a sure foundation. Me, Dublovitsky, and I, without preconcert, applied the same test to one spirit that appeared one evening. He was a great, stout Indian chief, in a red hunting shirt, leggings, and moccasins, and the lady mentally asked him to approach very near to where she sat, at the parlor organ, close against the railing. He did so, and gazing into her face, at not more than 2 or 3 feet distance, lifted up one of his feet and showed her the moccasin upon it. He retired into the cabinet, but I fixed my will intently upon him, and desired that he should return, once more and show himself to me also. He raised the curtain the next instant, came out, folded his arms, looked at me, lifted his foot and placed it on top of the railing with a most defiant air, and then disappeared again from our view. The last spirit to show himself on that evening, was one of the most impressive figures of the whole 400 or so I have seen. In 1851 me, Dubrovitsky was passing the summer at Darakichag, an Armenian place of summer resort in the plain of Mount Ararat. The name means the Valley of Flowers. Her husband, being vice-governor of Erivan, had a bodyguard of some 50 coward warriors, among whom one of the strongest and bravest, named Safar Ali Bek, Ibrahim Bek Oğlu, the son of Ibrahim, was detailed as the lady's personal escort. He rode after her everywhere on her daily equestrian excursions, and delighted to display his unusual skill as a cavalier. This very man walked out of William Eddy's cabinet in the form of a materialized spirit, dressed to the minutest detail, as when she last saw him in Asia. Madame was playing the parlor organ that evening, and as the back of the instrument was close against the platform, it brought her to within 3 or 4 feet of each of the spirits as they stood outside of the cabinet. There could be no mistaking her old cowardish nuker, and her recognition of him was immediate. He came out empty-handed, but just as I thought he was about to retire he bent forward, as if picking a handful of mould from the ground, made a gesture of scattering it, and pressed his hand to his bosom, gesture familiar only to the tribes of Kurdistan. Then, he suddenly held in his right hand the most curious-looking weapon I ever saw. It was a spear with a staff that might have been a dozen feet in length, perhaps more, for the butt seemed to extend into the cabinet, and a long steel head of peculiar shape, the base of which was surrounded with a ring of ostrich plumes. This weapon, me, Dubi, tells me, is always carried by the cowardish horsemen, who acquire a wonderful dexterity in handling it. One instant before, his hand was empty, the next, he grasps this spear, with its glittering steel barb and its wavy plumes. Whence came it? From Chittenden Township, Master Skeptic? On the evening of the 10th, every one of the 9 spirits appearing spoke to us, an unprecedented circumstance in my experience at Chittenden. Mrs. Pritchard's voice was clearer than usual. Maggie Brown managed to whisper a little. Mrs. Eddy spoke in very loud and clear tones, and advancing to the venerable and excellent Mr. Ralph, of Utica, N.Y., who sat upon the platform, knelt to him, kissed his hands and thanked him for his friendliness to her children, the scene being quite pathetic. Old Mrs. Cleveland's mother, a very wrinkled, white-haired dame, came to her daughter for the first time, a little child of a Mr. Whittier, of Massachusetts, a girl of about 4 years, I should judge, said Papa. Dear Papa, to him, and all seemed to conspire to assist the colloquial powers of the visitors from beyond the dark river. I never saw Honto in better spirits than upon that evening. It seemed as if she could not do enough to rid herself of her superabundant vitality. Laying a 323 hand upon the banister rail, she leapt clear over it to the room floor, and then resting a toe upon the platform edge, she leapt back again as lightly as an athlete. Running down the platform, and descending the steps, she caught Horatio by the hand and dragged him, unwilling, after her, up to the platform. Then she caught at old Mrs. Cleveland, and placed her beside him, and then, off she went to the other end, for the amiable Mr. Ralph, and pulled him towards the others, and then all four, with joined hands, had a merry dance together. If any fancy that Honto's face is but a mask covering William's features, let them consult Mr. Ralph, who has had opportunity enough to scan it, dear knows. Her affection for Auntie Cleveland seemed to overflow its bounds, for when the motherly old soul said how happy she felt to see her, the squaw threw her arms, this time materialized, about her and gave her a hearty hug. She materialized 2 of her shawls at once, pulling one after another out of the wall, and handing the 2 together to the unseen person within the cabinet. Then she made us a dozen more of all sizes, some of which appearing only as large as a towel, grew longer and wider as she walked back from Mrs. Cleveland, who held one end, until she had spun out of the air a fabric at least 16 feet in length and 1.5 yards in width. Old Mrs. Pritchard not only spoke to her son, but when that gentleman introduced her to Mr. Ralph, who sat beside him, she shook hands with him and addressed him some words of compliment. She did not even neglect Mrs. Cleveland, but called her over and greeted her also. With the 3 persons standing about her, she then turned to the audience, and told us that that was her son standing there, and she wanted us to know the fact. Mr. Ralph and Mrs. Cleveland, both of whom scrutinized her closely, told me that her face was that of an old lady, very much wrinkled, and that her son bears a strong resemblance to her. They saw her lips move when she spoke, noticed the color of her eyes, the details of her dress and figure, and felt her hands bedewed with a cold sweat. These facts are noteworthy, inasmuch as William's mustache was well grown at this time, and his face was rough with a week's beard stubble. Old Mr. Brown came out strong that evening, and laid about him with his tongue in fine style, giving reporters in general, and myself, by innuendo, in particular, a famous dressing down. Mrs. Eaton, also, who had usually been sweet friendly towards me, was viperish to a degree. I gave it up as a bad job, after that, concluding that it was useless to make any further attempts to put myself on good terms with the band directing these materializations, for the harder I tried to be kind to the mediums, and deferential and conciliatory to the spirits, the worse off I was. The Shaker Elder Evans seems to give a pretty clear idea of the situation, in his long communication to myself that will be found elsewhere. My influence must have stirred up the materializers, like a steamer's paddles the water. Chapter 20, The Dead Alive. The moon shone brightly the next evening, and everything out of doors favored a good circle. The air was clear and cool, every undulation of the mountain crests came out sharply against the sapphire sky in the glorious light, the little stream in the distance threaded the meadows, like silver set in emeralds, and, far up the valley, a brilliant aurora borealis shot its trembling spears of ruddy gold to the zenith, from behind the mountain barrier that shut in the horizon. A more peaceful scene I never viewed, and I turned from it with deep sadness to enter the gloomy circle room, where, judging from what had been going on the few preceding nights, I had every reason to expect demonstrations of ill temper and antagonism on the part of both the family and their spirit guides. 10 spirits appeared to us, among them a lady, a certain Mrs. Fulmer, who had only died the Friday previous. The relative to whom she came sat beside me, and was dreadfully agitated at the thought that one whom she had seen buried only a few days before, should so soon have burst the cerements of the grave. Poor woman, she was as little in reality a believer in the immortality of the soul, as most of her fellow church members, who pour their tears upon the coffin, instead of lifting the eyes of their faith upward, to where the disembodied spirit hangs lovingly over them. Among the forms to appear, was a man with a long black beard and dark complexion, wearing a turban, a red jacket embroidered with black braid, and inside vest of a flowered pattern, baggy trousers of dark blue or black, a sash around his waist, made of a twisted shawl, and black shoes. A person present, who had been coddled into the belief that he should see Lord Byron at the Eds, asked the spirit if he were not the great poet, and was answered in the affirmative, the which circumstance made me recall a certain passage at Proverbs 26:5. The vanity, ignorance, and credulity of mortal spiritualists has been the cause of what Mr. Bagnall Daly would call a mighty sight of elegant lying, on the part of the spirits. It so consoles your costermonger to think he can chaff the shade of Charlemagne. This spirit, who, I may mention in passing, reappeared at my mental request after he had retired, had hardly been gone an instant, when there came a light-complexioned, white-haired old man, a Mr. Jonathan Bartlett, taller than the Diaca Lord Byron, and dressed throughout in an American costume. He must have been waiting for his predecessor to retire, for he almost passed him at the door, and the circumstance was noted in my book as another proof in favor of the apparitions being something else than personations by the medium. 327. My Kako visited us again the next evening, and spoke to me, Dobrovitsky, in the Georgian tongue, and, after 2 or 3 more forms had shown themselves, I saw one of the most singular creatures that ever excited the wonder of a circle. He was a tall, spare negro, black as ink, and dressed in a curious costume, 2 features of which were very conspicuous. Upon his woolly head he had a coiffure that would make a sensation on Broadway. I could see an ornamented fillet, or band, and on top of his head 4 horns with bent tips, something like those of the chamois or some varieties of African antelope, such as the oryx. The points of the two in front were turned backward, and those of the two in rear, forward, while a brass or gilt ball hung suspended from each tip. Me. Dublovitsky did not recognize him at first, but he stepped forward a pace or two, and she then saw before her the chief of a party of African jugglers whom she encountered once in Upper Egypt, at a celebration of the Feast of the Ramazan. The magical performances of his party upon that occasion make one of the most incredible stories in the history of either magic or spiritualism, and one feat deserves place in such a book of weird experiences as this. Madame says that, in full sight of a multitude, comprising several hundred Europeans and many thousand Egyptians and Africans, the juggler came out on a bare space of ground, leading a small boy, stark naked, by the hand, and carrying a huge roll of tape that might be 12 or 18 inches wide. After certain ceremonies, he whirled the roll about his head several times, and then flung it straight up into the air. Instead of falling back to earth after it had ascended a short distance, it kept on upward, unwinding and unwinding interminably from the stick, until it grew to be a mere speck, and finally passed out of sight. The juggler drove the pointed end of the stick into the ground, and then beckoned the boy to approach. Pointing upward, and talking in a strange jargon, he seemed to be ordering the little fellow to ascend the self-suspended tape, which by this time stood straight and stiff, as if it were a board whose end rested against some solid support up in mid-air. The boy bowed compliance, and began climbing, using his hands and feet as little all-right does when climbing Satsuma's balance pole. The boy went higher and higher until he, too, seemed to pass into the clouds and disappear. The juggler waited 5 or 10 minutes, and then, pretending to be impatient, shouted up to his assistant as if to order him down. No answer was heard, and no boy appeared, so, finally, as if carried away with rage, the juggler thrust a naked sword into his breech clout, the only garment upon his person, and climbed after the boy, up and up and up, hand over hand, and step by step, he ascended, until the straining eyes of the multitude saw him no more. There was a moment's pause, and then a wild shriek came down from the sky, and a bleeding arm, as if freshly cut from the boy's body, fell with a horrid thud upon the ground. Then came another, then the two legs, one after the other, then the dismembered trunk, and, last of all, the ghastly head, every part streaming with gore and covering the ground. 331. A second lad now stepped forward, and, gathering the mutilated fragments of his comrade into a heap, threw a dirty cloth over them and retired. Presently the juggler was seen descending as slowly and cautiously as he had ascended. He reached the ground at last, with his naked sword all dripping with blood. Paying no attention to the remains of his supposed victim, he went to rewinding his tape upon his stick, his audience meanwhile breaking out into cries of impatience and execration. When the tape was all rewound, he wiped his sword, and then, deliberately stepping to the bloody heap, lifted off the ragged quilt, and uprose the little tape climber as hearty as ever, and bowed and smiled upon the amazed throng as though dismemberment were an after-breakfast pastime to which he had been accustomed from infancy. I have seen it stated in the papers that the late William H. Seward, ex-Secretary of State, witnessed a similar feat in India, while on his tour around the world. He saw a man climb a bare pole 60 feet high, standing in open air, and when he reached the top he mysteriously disappeared. After a while his feet reappeared, then his legs and body, and then he came down. It is a great pity that some of our enterprising publishers could not induce me, Dublovitsky, to write out her memoirs, for they abound in such marvels as these. And, be it remembered, the great Negro whom I saw at Chittenden was the chief of the very party who performed the marvel of diablerie in Egypt. But, whoever he was, or wherever he hails from, is it possible that William Eddy could get himself up, in his 2 by 7 feet, pitch-dark cabinet, to look like this strange creature, without lamp, paint, looking-glass, soap, or water, and only a small black fringed shawl and piece of plaid horse blanket, taken from serving their purpose as curtains, to be used as costume? There are curious stories afloat in Egypt about the powers of the chiefs of this horned jugglers tribe, one of which, recited to me by Madame de B, is well worth preserving, as a match to the Grecian mythological fable of Europa. One of them had the reputation of being the greatest sorcerer ever known in that country. By conjurations he could evoke the shape of any person he chose, and make it do his bidding. He was aided by demons, or evil spirits of mighty power, who came and went at his beck and call, as unquestioningly as the genie of the ring and lamp did for the audacious Aladdin. One day he strolled into the village of Mismassa, near the River Nile, and, going from house to house, offered his services to do any little odd job of diablerie that might be required. In Mismassa was a pretty maiden, named Esma, who had been abandoned by her sweetheart, Zanoni Bey, and who asked the conjurer if he could not force the faithless one back to her feet. He said he could, if she could only procure him a lock of Zanoni's hair, be it never so small a one. Not being able to approach the renegade herself, she sent her little brother, a lad about 12 years of age, on the difficult mission. But he, finding his efforts likely to prove unsuccessful, stepped into a butcher's yard, and cut some hairs from the tail of a black bull that was waiting his turn to be slaughtered, and brought them to his sister, as taken from Zanoni's head. The deception was rendered possible from the fact that the lover's hair was very coarse and black, as much Arab hair is. Esma, with fear and trembling, delivered the lock to the magician, who began his mystic rites in her presence, thus, at least, showing us that he was no genuine clairvoyant, since he did not discover the cheat. He made his passes and genuflections, sprinkled his powders, and muttered his Arabic charms, until the subservient powers of darkness manifested their presence by shaking the house to its foundations, and the air seemed full of strange and fearful whisperings. After a few more passes, the sorcerer exclaimed the talismanic words which signify that the spell is formed, and handing the lock of hair to the affrighted girl, received his fee, and departed. Impatiently she waited for night to come, and restore the truant Zanoni to her caresses. She decked herself in her bravest attire, and watched the unprophetic hours pass by, until the midnight call of the muezzin from the neighboring mosque betokened the fateful moment. Suddenly there was a noise like that of distant thunder, the earth shook, the house door flew open, and there, upon the threshold, she beheld a tall, black figure with horns. Taking it for the conjurer himself, she overwhelmed him with reproaches for his perfidy, but in another moment the dark object disclosed itself as the empty skin of a slaughtered bull, standing, erect upon its hind legs. She shrieked in mortal fright, but in vain. The monster, as if carried away with a mad frenzy, precipitated itself upon her, and wrapped her in an embrace of death. Her cries were heard and her struggles witnessed by an old Negro servant woman, the only other tenant of the house, who stood a while, rooted to the floor with terror, and then fell in a dead swoon. Upon recovering her senses, the morning light shone dimly into the apartment, and there lay the poor Esma, dead and cold, enveloped in the bull's hide. The sorcerer had rehabilitated the spirit of the beast, and endowed it with a mad affection for the lovelorn dam. This story was told to me, Dobby, by Elias Effendi, a dignitary residing at Mismassa, who assured her that it was generally believed throughout all that section of country. The adventure occurred only about a year before me. Dobby's visit, and the hide of this African Europa's four-legged swain was exhibited to her in attestation of the truth of the narrative. Miss Tripp's sergeant writes me from Boston, under date of December 3, 1874, as follows: "By the way, that curious story of the feat witnessed by me, Dublovitsky, where the African juggler throws up a ladder or rope into the sky, is paralleled in a story, which you may find in a record book by George Lunt, editor of the Boston Courier, giving reminiscences of Newburyport, and other places in New England. He relates an incident of the same kind, in some respects, as occurring somewhere in these parts, many years ago. I regret to say, that I have not been able to obtain access to Mr. Lunt's book in time to use the extract referred to by Mr. Sargent. I cannot imagine how such a thing could have occurred in this country, unless some vagrant Egyptian or Hindu magician might have wandered this way. In his voluminous work entitled Des rapports de l'homme avec le démon, Parra said, 1863, volume I, p. 15, m.